Today is Tuesday the 14th of April, and you are listening to the World Socialist website. Trump's blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, the next phase in the Iran war. Andre Damon, April 13, 2026. The US military announced Monday that it had begun blocking all ships entering or leaving Iranian ports, marking a major escalation in the US war against Iran and the effective abrogation by the United States of the ceasefire announced 6 days earlier by Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif. U.S. President Donald Trump declared on Truth Social on Sunday that the Navy would, quote, begin the process of blockading any and all ships trying to enter or leave the Strait of Hormuz, end of quote. Two guided missile destroyers entered the strait on Saturday, and the Wall Street Journal reported that 15 U.S. warships are now deployed to enforce the blockade. The blockade is an act of war and an act of international piracy. The World Socialist website condemns this criminal action, directed against Iran and against the working class of the entire world, which will pay the price in soaring energy costs, food shortages, and the ever-present danger of a wider military conflagration. The ceasefire has proven to be an opportunity, using Trump's own phrase, to, quote, reload for the next phase of the war. Every ceasefire Trump has announced in the Middle East, from Gaza in January 2025, to Iran in June 2025, to the April 7 Iran ceasefire, followed hours later by Israel's strike on central Beirut that killed more than 250 people, has been a pause to regroup for the next attack. Control of the Strait of Hormuz, and with it the oil production and distribution of Iran and the Persian Gulf region as a whole, has been a central strategic aim of the war from the outset. Since the war began, shipping through the strait has collapsed. Transit volumes have fallen by more than 90% from pre-war levels. What traffic remains has been dominated by Iran's shadow fleet and Greek-affiliated tankers carrying crude to China, Iran's largest customer, which takes 80 to 90% of its oil exports. Iran has continued to allow passage to ships bound for its aligned trading partners, above all China. Any ship that now attempts to cross into the strait to reach an Iranian port does so without American permission, opening up the possibility of a physical attack against any country whose ships trade with Iran. Chinese Defense Minister Dong Yong stated Monday, quote, our ships are moving in and out of the waters of the Strait of Hormuz. We have trade and energy agreements with Iran. We will respect and honor them and expect others not to meddle in our affairs, end of quote. The blockade of the Strait of Hormuz is in practice an act of economic warfare against China, as much as against Iran. Nearly half of China's oil and more than a third of its liquefied natural gas flow through the Strait of Hormuz. The blockade places America's hand on the energy supply of its principal rival and on that of its allies, Japan, South Korea, and the states of the European Union, which depend on the same flows. Trump hinted at the thinking of U.S. military strategists at a press briefing Monday. Quote, we don't need this trade. We have our own oil, gas, much more than we need. So we don't need it, but the world needs it, and many ships are heading to our country right now, as we speak, to load up. The blockade is part of a broader U.S. campaign to seize the world's strategic choke points. The Strait of Hormuz, the Panama Canal, the approaches to Greenland. American imperialism, in long-term economic decline, is attempting to offset that decline through military domination of global trade routes, securing the world's waterways and raw materials for itself and denying them to its rivals, above all China. In December 2025, U.S. forces seized a China-bound oil tanker carrying 1.8 million barrels of Venezuelan crude off the coast of Venezuela. The Hormuz blockade extends that precedent to the Persian Gulf and raises the direct danger of military confrontation with China if US warships attempt to turn around Chinese-bound tankers. The economic consequences of American imperialism's criminal war against Iran are already catastrophic. Even before the blockade, this substantial cutting off of transit through the Strait of Hormuz has generated what the International Energy Agency has called the worst oil crisis in history, surpassing 1979. Oil is above $100 a barrel. Gasoline stands at $4.13 a gallon. Nationally, and more than 600 ships remain trapped in the Gulf. Goldman Sachs has raised the probability of a US recession to 30%. A third of global fertilizer supply normally passes through the strait. The war has not only disrupted immediate trade, but it will have a severe impact on next season's crop yields. Smaller harvests across Africa, South Asia, and Latin America. Food price shocks reaching countries with no direct stake in the Gulf. Hundreds of millions face food insecurity, and tens of millions could die. Global famine is a real possibility. Within its plan for world domination, the actual conduct of the war has been characterized by increasingly desperate improvisation. On February the 28th, the United States launched the war and killed Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei and dozens of senior Iranian officials. Trump called on Iranians to rise against their government, and they did not. The bombing campaign that followed destroyed Iran's telecommunications and leveled districts of its cities, but Iran did not surrender. Further assassinations of Iranian leaders through March did not bring the government down. The blockade is the next step. US warships are now operating at close range inside a waterway 21 miles wide at its narrowest point. Flanked by Iranian missile batteries, coastal defenses, and thousands of naval mines, Trump said Monday that any Iranian ships approaching the blockade would be, quote, immediately eliminated. The loss of a destroyer or a mass casualty event would intensify demands within the US political establishment for a ground invasion, including the seizure of Karg Island, through which 90% of Iran's oil exports are processed. Marines and troops from the 82nd Airborne Division are already deployed, and more than 50,000 U.S. service members are in the theater. 13 U.S. service members have been killed since February the 28th. The Trump regime is proceeding with staggering recklessness. He has said openly that the United States will take Iran's oil, a declaration of plunder that past administrations would have disguised behind the language of sanctions and international law. The methods of the criminal underworld are now official state policy. The political establishment objects to none of this in principle. The New York Times editorial board called Trump's conduct, quote, glaring incompetence and urged him to, quote, involve Congress and seek help from America's allies. A call for bipartisan collaboration in the prosecution of the next stage of the war. The Wall Street Journal called Trump's victory declaration premature, and warned that, quote, the job is far from finished, end of quote. Democratic Party Senator Tim Kaine told ABC Sunday that Iran is, quote, a regional threat, and that, quote, we need to make sure that Iran doesn't get a nuclear weapon, end of quote. When Trump announced the ceasefire a week ago, the Democrats rushed to criticize it on the basis that it left control of the Strait of Hormuz in Iran's hands. The Democrats accept the strategic objectives and object only to the execution. If every wing of the American political establishment endorses the war, opposition to it can only come from outside the establishment altogether. The working class must oppose the blockade and the war as a whole through its own independent political mobilization. The war is being paid for through a historic assault on the social programs working people depend on to live. At a White House lunch on April the 1st, Trump said the government cannot afford Medicare, Medicaid, and other social programs because it is fighting wars. The same class being asked to pay for the war in cuts to essential programs is the one being called on to fight it. Automatic draft registration for all men aged 18 to 26 takes effect in December 2026, signed into law by Trump as part of the 2026 National Defense Authorization Act. The children of steel workers and warehouse workers, of miners and migrant farmhands, will now be sent to die on the destroyers and on the beaches of the Persian Gulf to secure China's energy supply for American imperialism. The fight against war is inseparable from the fight against the destruction of social programs, the drive towards conscription and the establishment of a military police dictatorship, The fight to defend jobs, wages and living standards must be united with the struggle against imperialist war and against the root cause of these social maladies, the capitalist system. With strike deadline approaching, Los Angeles officials and unions moved to block walkout of 80,000 school workers. Tom Hall, Mark Wells, Ivan Cadenas, 14th of April 2026. With hours to go before a potential strike by 80,000 Los Angeles school workers, negotiations between SEIU Local 99 and the Los Angeles Unified Schools District are continuing under intense pressure from city and political officials. As of this writing, this includes Mayor Karen Bass, who has been directly involved in talks Monday night. The last-minute negotiations follow the announcement Sunday of tentative agreements by United Teachers Los Angeles, UTLA, and the Associated Administrators of Los Angeles, AALA, moves that have already served to divide workers and weaken the prospect of unified strike action. Taken together, these developments constitute a coordinated effort to prevent a joint walkout and impose a settlement before rank-and-file workers can act. This would also isolate a separate potential strike by 200 teachers in the Little Lake City School District, a southeast Los Angeles county, which is set to begin Thursday. School workers must act now to oppose these efforts. Educators and staff should organize rank-and-file committees among their co-workers at each school to fight the sabotage of union officials and impose the democratic will of the rank-and-file to proceed with a walkout. The strike must go ahead, but under rank-and-file control, not unaccountable bureaucrats. These committees will form the basis for making the broadest possible appeal for support among workers in Los Angeles, the United States, and around the world. On Monday, a rally was held in downtown Los Angeles, bringing together educators and supporters and growing tensions over the contracts and the threat of a strike. The mood among workers was one of anger and determination, sharply contrasting with the attitude of union officials. What is taking place are not negotiations in the sense of two adversarial parties. It is a conspiracy of the Democratic Party through the city government, LAUSD, and the union bureaucracy to sabotage the class struggle, which terrifies them above all. The union bureaucracy, joined at the hip with management and the capitalist parties, is a full partner in this effort because a genuine struggle by workers would undermine these corrupt relations. Similar betrayals have already taken place this year across America, including among nurses in New York City and at Kaiser Permanente, San Francisco teachers, the United Auto Workers' blocking of a strike at NexTier, and the shutdown of a strike at Bath Ironworkers, a major defense contractor. The intervention of Mayor Karen Bass recalls the role of San Francisco Mayor Daniel Lurie and former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi in shutting down a four-day strike by educators earlier this year. Also involved in that intervention was American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten, who is also a top Democratic Party operative and former member of the Democratic National Committee. Soon afterward, the San Francisco School District announced layoffs as part of its, quote, fiscal recovery program. At a separate event Sunday in New York City featuring Bernie Sanders, Zoran Mandani, and Randy Weingarten, the role of the union apparatus was made explicit. At the rally, Weingarten hailed the LA teachers' contract, declaring, quote, "And just this morning at 4, UTLA got a contract that our members and the kids in LA deserve," end of quote. The frantic attempts to block a strike are taking place as war preparations intensify against Iran, with talks breaking down and threats to annihilate Iranian civilization. This war, driven by the struggle for control over oil and strategic interest, is deeply unpopular, and its disastrous consequences will trigger massive opposition. The ruling class is acting to suppress this opposition. At the same time, a massive funding crisis confronts school districts across the country as resources are siphoned away to Wall Street and war. In Los Angeles, a city marked by extreme wealth and poverty, the district faces a projected deficit of $877 million for the 2026-27 school year, with another $443 million in red ink anticipated the following year, despite holding multi-billion dollar reserves. In February, the school board approved a plan expected to eliminate 657 central and regional office staff positions as part of a county-approved, quote, fiscal stabilization regime. No matter what union officials say about their tentative agreements, this means that huge cuts face educators once they ratify the deals, or even before, as long as this deficit remains. Educators must raise the demand that it be filled, not through cuts, but through the wealth of the rich and the major corporations, which is more than enough to provide high-quality education for all. The UTLA and the AALA agreements provide for an 11.65% wage increase over 2 years, with some teachers receiving as little as 8%. They include toothless fines for violations of special education class size ratios and vague, unspecified, quote, commitments in support of immigrant students and families, end of quote. The AALA highlights are even more vague, while promoting the same wage framework. They include a defined 8-hour day and 40-hour work week, along with longevity bonuses and stipend pay for some high seniority principals. The agreements are being used to undermine a unified strike and pressure SEIU 99 workers, who are among the lowest paid in the district, with average annual earnings of roughly $35,000, a poverty wage in one of the most expensive cities in the country. In talks, the SEIU initially put forward a demand for a 30% raise over 3 years, which is modest given the cost of living. In response, LAUSD has offered a 13% increase, along with off-schedule bonuses instead of genuine retroactive pay. Given that workers have been without a contract for 22 months, this offer would amount to little more than back pay. Opposition among workers is widespread and growing, particularly online, remarking on the fact that SEIU 99 remains at the table while UTLA and AALA have already accepted tentative agreements. One commenter said, quote, they should absolutely hold out for a better deal. Just because other unions caved, that doesn't mean the others should. Why did UTLA begrudgingly accept the crappy 8% raise for so many of their long-time members? This is literally the ideal situation for the unions to have negotiated a much better deal across the board, since everyone was striking and all contracts were being negotiated at the same time. End of quote. One worker spoke out against the claim that, quote, there is no money for schools, saying, quote, the money is there and has been there. LAUSD has $5 billion in reserves, and they are on average near 900% off on their 3-year budget projections since about 2014. Imagine someone telling you they can't pay you for the work you did and agreed to because they've got $100 in debt, and you find out that they have $800 in the bank for safekeeping. Another worker raised the crushing cost of living in Los Angeles, driven above all by housing. Quote, everything really just comes back to the insane cost of living in this city due to expensive housing, one person wrote. Quote, I have a neighbour who taught at LAUSD but couldn't afford to live in LA anymore, end of quote. Workers must draw the necessary conclusions and act immediately. If a tentative agreement is announced overnight, it should not be accepted as binding. Full details must be made available immediately, and any attempt to cancel strike action must be opposed. The struggle must be taken out of the hands of the union bureaucracy, which has sold out one struggle after another across the country. Across all unions, workers must form independent rank-and-file committees to break the isolation, share information, organize from below, and assert their democratic will. These committees can provide the means to overturn sellouts and ensure that the decisions are made by workers themselves. Educators and school workers must appeal to the broader working class, linking their struggle to a wider fight against inequality and in defence of the rights of immigrants and all workers. This requires the independent mobilisation of the working class against the oligarchy. Hungary, which way forward after Orbán's electoral defeat? Peter Schwartz, April 13, 2026. Democracy has won was the headline of German magazine Die Zeit's comment on the Hungarian elections. Numerous other European media outlets and politicians reacted in a similar vein, describing the election of Peter Margar's teaser party alternately as a, quote, victory for democracy and a victory for Europe. Yet this assessment has little to do with political reality. Viktor Orban, who described his own regime as, quote, illiberal democracy, served as a role model for numerous authoritarian politicians, from Donald Trump to Marine Le Pen and Giorgia Meloni, did indeed suffer a heavy defeat after 16 years in power. With a record turnout of 78%, Orban's Fidesz secured just 38.3% of the vote, while Tisza won 53.2%, as only one other party, the far-right Our Homeland, managed to enter the new parliament. Tisza will even hold the two-thirds majority of MPs required for constitutional amendments. Yet for the working class, that is the vast majority of the Hungarian population, the change of government in Budapest will make little difference. Election winner Magyar not only hails from Fidesz's inner circle of power, but during the campaign he also constantly appealed to disaffected members of Orbán's party and refrained from any criticism of its political line. He intends to stick to both their inhumane refugee policy and their discrimination against ethnic minorities and LGBTQ people. At least he gave no indication to the contrary during the campaign. Magyar attempted to outdo Fidesz's nationalism by constantly waving a Hungarian flag at campaign rallies. Magyar's sole campaign issue was the rampant nepotism and corruption that now pervades the country like a cancer and is covered up by a judiciary and media placed firmly under state control. While such allegations of corruption had previously bounced off Orbán, they are now having an effect due to the economic crisis. In terms of per capita consumption, Hungary now ranks last among the 27 EU member states. The population has been in decline for some time due to the bleak outlook for the future. During Orbán's time in office, it fell from 10 million to less than 9.5 million. Under these circumstances, it was not only the urban population and young people who voted overwhelmingly for Tisza to get rid of Orbán. Tisza also managed to score points in Fidesz's traditional rural strongholds, which are favoured by the electoral system. However, Magyar had no answer to the social crisis. On the contrary, his electoral success is only a victory for Europe, if by, quote, Europe, one does not mean the continent's population, but rather the conspiracy of great powers, corporations and banks that calls itself the European Union, the EU. The EU is focusing all its energy on rearmament, escalating the war against Russia and passing on the cost to the working class through cuts to social services and redundancies. Orbán was a thorn in the side of the Brussels authorities because he maintained relations with Russian President Putin and repeatedly stood in the way of the war in Ukraine. Most recently, he used his veto to block an EU loan of 90 billion euros to Ukraine, which had already been approved and which Ukraine urgently needs to continue the war. The EU is confident that Magyar will approve this loan. That is why Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, who is actually bound to remain neutral in national elections, enthusiastically welcomed Magyar's election victory. Quote, "Tonight the heart of Europe beats stronger in Hungary," she wrote on X. In the final phase of the election campaign, Orbán focused on the unpopularity of the war in Ukraine among the Hungarian population and waged a campaign against Kiev. But this did not save him any more than the campaign support from Donald Trump, who publicly backed him and sent Vice President J.D. Vance to Budapest as a campaign aide. Vance's appearance in the midst of the war in Iran, which is also opposed by the population, is likely to have weakened Orbán rather than strengthened him. Unlike Orbán, Magyar was backed by the EU. Since his election to the European Parliament 2 years ago, he has been a member of the Conservative European People's Party, the EPP group, which also includes EU Commission President von der Leyen and German Chancellor Friedrich Merz. EPP leader Manfred Weber travelled to Budapest specifically in the summer of 2024 to recruit Teza into the EPP. It is reasonable to assume that the EPP provided significant support for the small party's professional election campaign, which is entirely tailored to Magar's persona. Unlike with Trump's intervention, however, the EPP is not particularly troubled by this. Politically, the EPP is on the far right. Until 2021, Orbán's Fidesz was also a member of the EPP. Later, it joined forces with France's Rassemblement National to form a new political group, Patriots for Europe. In Italy, EPP leader Weber supported Silvio Berlusconi's election campaign and by extension that of Giorgia Meloni. Magyar himself comes from an established family of lawyers in Budapest. His wife, Judit Varga, served as Minister of Justice under Orbán from 2019 to 2023, while he himself held a lucrative post as head of the Student Loan Agency. In 2024, Magyar then published secret audio recordings of his wife, from whom he had recently separated. In them, she spoke of corruption and interference in the judiciary. With the publication, Magyar provoked a scandal that brought him national attention. Just how far to the right Hungarian politics remains, even after Orbán's defeat, is shown by the fact that in the new parliament, even within the narrow spectrum of bourgeois politics, there is no longer a single party that describes itself as left-wing or centrist. The parliament will consist of Magyar's conservative Tisza, Orbán's authoritarian Fidesz, and the fascist Our Homeland. The interests of the working class are not represented in even a completely distorted form. This situation is untenable. The class struggle is bound to break out, encouraged also by workers' struggles across Europe and internationally. Workers and young people who voted for Magyar to get rid of Orbán will soon realise that nothing has been resolved. Magyar and the capitalist interests he defends have nothing to offer but more poverty, sharper exploitation and war. Orbán evolved from a Stalinist student functionary to a liberal student leader, then a conservative and finally an authoritarian ruler. His career was initially promoted by the US investor George Soros, whom he would later demonise. The evolution did not simply stem from Orbán's bad character, but from the logic of capitalism, which can now only assert itself globally through dictatorship and war. Magyar is also subject to this same logic. To break out of this vicious circle, a socialist perspective is necessary, one that unites the international working class in the struggle against capitalism. It must be based on a clear understanding of history. To this day, the defenders of capitalism invoke the crimes of Stalinism to justify their own crimes. They reinterpret the 1956 Hungarian uprising, which was brutally crushed by Soviet tanks, as an anti-communist, pro-capitalist revolt. In reality, it was a workers' uprising that sought to replace the dictatorship of the Stalinist bureaucracy with genuine workers' democracy. Capitalism was only introduced later under Gorbachev and Yeltsin in the Soviet Union and Nemeth in Hungary by the Stalinists themselves. Orbán came to national prominence in 1989 when, during the reburial of Imre Nagy, who had been executed in 1958 following the Hungarian uprising, he spoke out in favour of the withdrawal of Soviet troops from Hungary. At Magyar's victory celebration on Sunday evening, his supporters chanted, "Russians out!" a slogan from the 1956 uprising. Ursula von der Leyen also recalled the 1956 uprising when she congratulated Magyar on his election victory. This distortion of history must be rejected. Stalinism did not embody socialism. It was its gravedigger. Under Stalin, a privileged bureaucracy seized the power that the Russian working class had won in October 1917. It was responsible for numerous defeats of the international working class, and during the Great Terror of the 1930s, murdered hundreds of thousands of devoted communists and revolutionaries, including Leon Trotsky, the leader of the left opposition and founder of the Fourth International. After the Second World War, the Stalinist bureaucracy extended the inherently progressive property relations of the Soviet Union to Eastern Europe, without revolution and without workers' democracy. Where workers rose up against Stalinism, as in 1953 in East Europe, 1956 in Poland and Hungary, or 1968 in Czechoslovakia, they were crushed. When in the 1980s a mass movement against Stalinist rule developed once again, starting in Poland, the regime responded, as Trotsky had already predicted in the 1930s, by reintroducing capitalism. Orban and Magyar are the reactionary beneficiaries of this social counter-revolution. For these articles and more, go to the World Socialist website, wsws.org. For the World Socialist website, this has been Carol Diviak.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.